It's so wild that y'all had the reading there. I remember one time I got asked to speak over Norfolk, and they read that more about alcoholism. And I just did my whole time talking to the lines in that, because it was me, just big time me. And I was sitting here, I remembered something, just wanted to share from the beginning, because I know we've got a couple of new people. As I was thinking about this all day, I was like, well, what can I do? And I made a couple of notes during a meeting last night about, hey, this is what I could do. But always when you hear there's a newcomer, it's like, okay, now I know what we got to do. I know what we got to talk about a little bit. This thing says here, if you have a drinking problem, we hope that you may pause in reading any of the 42 personal stories that are in the back of the book after verse 164 attached. And it says, and you might be able to say, yes, that happened to me, or yes, I felt like that, or most importantly, I believe this program can work for me too. And that's the one thing, because I never know what I'm going to say when I get up here, right? Because I'm going to talk about the 12 steps, and I'm going to talk about this big book because it's what I know. If anything, whatever I start talking about and wherever I go in this here, please just remember, the most important thing is that this isn't about me. It's like I'm not special. I'm just a garden variety drunk. And I was a garden variety drunk the first time I came to AA at 22 years old. And I was the same garden variety drunk at 46 when I crashed back into AA. And I literally did crash back in AA. But I had more money when I came back the second time. I had 2 kids, a wife, a motorcycle, a good job, security clearance that I thought I might lose at 46. First time I came to AA at 22, I didn't have nothing. I came from Mississippi with my Monte Carlo with some albums and a guitar. And that was probably about it when I came up from Mississippi looking for a job up here in Virginia. I was here in Virginia for about a year before I got a DUI. I'll go into just a little bit where I came from too, because yes, that happened to me and maybe I felt like that. There's something very common with all of us alcoholics. And I did start drinking young. I know when I was 13, I was an altar boy at my uncle's wedding in Jamestown, New York. The reception was at the Puerto Rican Social Club. And it was so cool that I could go up there and say, this is for my uncle, and I could get a rum and coke. And they would give it to me. And then I would get my cousins, and we'd go out back, and we'd drink our little rum and cokes. And I got hammered. And it was like one of my first blackouts at 13. And blackouts is that instance where you have a lot of fun, you drink a lot, and you don't remember what it is. And you remember pieces and parts, right? So I did it at 13. By the time I was 15, I was going to the liquor store that the two old ladies ran on Thursday night to buy the booze on Thursday night, because if you tried to go there on Friday night, the young guy that ran the place wouldn't sell it to you, because he knew you weren't 18. But the old ladies, they didn't know. I remember handing her my library card, you know, and that worked. What drove me to drink like that? You know, yeah, my dad left when I was young, and yeah, it was a whole lot of stuff that was not good that I remember from being young. And when he left, I was torn between, yes, he's gone, I won't get beat up for not eating all my dinner anymore. But at the same time, this was in the 70s, and it was before credit cards. And I know some people don't understand that. But when mom didn't have any money, we didn't eat. So I grew up on bologna sandwiches and hot dogs, mac and cheese, and cereal. And plenty of times, what do we have for dinner? And it was cereal, because that's all that was in the house, right? I think that kind of shapes you just a little bit. It did me. Is that when I got older, I had a real sense of entitlement, maybe, about I deserved whatever it is that I wanted. And when you put that kind of thought into a little alcoholic brain, that applied to everything. It applied to women, booze, and pot. And I'm not going to talk about pot, because this is AA, and I'm not a potaholic by any chance or anything, but it was easier to get pot when I was 15 than it was to get alcohol. And then when I got older, and when I tried some of those ways of not drinking that are red in there, I tried all of it. And one time I even tried quitting booze altogether. I had watched Billy Graham on TV, and I came that close to getting saved. Because he almost had me. Almost had me. But what I did was I decided that I could just drink wine. So it was my Jesus version of staying sober. Because I was drinking wine, I was smoking pot. But I wasn't hitting hard booze anymore, and I wasn't drinking cases of beer. And that was when I was about 18, 19. So in New York, playing hockey and having fun, playing guitar, and I was seriously got caught up in the whole drinking and drugging thing. And once I drank, in the doctor's opinion, it talks about the mental obsession and the physical, you know, compulsion to drink more. So at an early age, I found out that when I caught a buzz, it made me feel good all over. And I loved that. And I loved to do it as much as I could. So being a paperboy was a thing back then. And it didn't make a lot of money, but it made enough to buy some beer. And I had an older cousin that was almost 18 that could go buy beer because he looked 18. And I remember us also standing out in front of the store and waiting to find somebody who made eye contact that we could say, here's some money, can you buy us some beers? And they would do that back then, you know. It's different now, I'm sure. But so 15, I remember playing hockey and then going away for a weekend where we had somebody's cabin, and we all brought our stashes with us, and we did nothing but drink for 2 days. And when mom came to pick me up like Sunday afternoon, she's like, you look terrible. Because all we'd been doing is drinking and eating a little bit, you know. And we thought that was just the greatest fun in the world. And I repeated that. And I was at 15. I repeated that kind of thing many times in my life as I got older. So 15, and then having problems with my mom, having problems with everybody, la, la, la. And I had gone down to Mississippi where my grandparents had moved. And my dad was living down there, and I thought Mississippi was just a great place, so different from Western New York, Jamestown, Buffalo, that I wanted to move down there. And part of the reason that I wanted to move down there, and this is just one of the insanities of this early alcoholism stuff, is there was part of me that was starting to think about how could I off my mother? And you know, being a Catholic boy growing up, to have that thought of I can't stand her so much, that what can I do with the body? That was freaking me out. So I talked to my grandfather. I said, look, you got to get me out. My mom is driving me crazy. Now, there's another theme in my life that, of course, I didn't know any better, but if something bothered me, it was their fault that made me think of doing bad things. And so anyways, I did. I moved down to Mississippi, and it was great because they were partying, and it was beer on the beach, as Mississippi Gulf Coast. And I really thought I'd found my people at that point, you know. I got my first rock and roll band then at like 16. I was 17 and I was playing in bars, and you had to be 18 to be in, you know, drinking in there. It was 18 and 21 for booze. And I remember turning 18, my birthday's January 1st, New Year's Day. And we were playing a New Year's Eve gig at this place that I used to drink at all the time. And Louie, who's also a part-time police officer, I remember him slapping me on the back saying, you know, happy birthday. I heard it's your 18th birthday. I was like, yeah, sorry, Louie. but that's the way we rolled. And being in the band got me to being on the road when I was 19. And this was 1984. And we were on the road, Mississippi, Alabama, Florida. And one time we had a gig in Daytona Beach. And it's 1984 in Daytona Beach. And they liked us the first week, and they kept us there for 3 weeks in a row. And it was a nonstop party. And every night, it was one of the older guys in the band had taught me a trick, which is just find the woman that looks like she's got some money and can take you home and feed you. Because that's the way to do it, you know? It doesn't matter what she looks like. And then this is kind of a men's meeting here, so. And so that flavored, you know, number one, I wanted to party all the time. and I wanted to get laid, and I wanted to play music. And I thought I wanted that rock and roll lifestyle. But even when I was in Mississippi before this, I do remember sitting out on the dock, getting drunk with my buddies, and thinking, is this all there is to life? We got our buzz, we wanted the buzz, we caught the buzz is good. But is this all there is to life? And I was kind of, I had had that at an early age, there's gotta be more to life than just getting wasted, you know? And of course you do dumb stuff and other people do dumb stuff, and you're always around people that drink too much and just act like jerks. I was more of a loving drunk, you know? I was one more bound to give everybody hugs when I was drinking anyways. Anyways, in this 3 weeks in Daytona, I got to sample a little bit of everything that I thought I wanted in life. I felt like a rock star, a mini version of a rock star, and was just, the party was on. And it was too many times during that 3 weeks I found myself going, man, this sucks. I got what I wanted. This sucks. But that concept of opening the beer, thinking, you know, I don't even want this, but that was at 19, and that kept rolling on into my later life too. So at 19, somewhere amidst having all of this fun, which I knew sooner or later God was going to zap me for something. And so I came back, that band was having a tough time, so we came back to Mississippi, and somewhere along the line with one of these women I got hooked up with, I ended up getting herpes. And for a young guy in 1984, my life was over with. And I don't know if they had pills back then. I didn't know, because I wouldn't have gone to the doctors anyways. I was embarrassed, I was ashamed. So I'm an alcoholic, so what did I do? There was only one thing to do. Drink to the bitter end. I'm gonna die a lonely old man under a bridge somewhere. So I might as well just drink. And for whatever work ethic I had, I wasn't just gonna go live under a bridge. I knew I had to work to afford to have money for the beer to live, you know? And so that was always kept me going. And so I drank through my 19th, I was 19 when that happened. And 20, 21, I moved up here to Virginia because the jobs were bad in Mississippi. Moved up here, my mom was up here. Said, there's jobs all over the place. So I came up here and I found some cousins up here, and the party was on again, right? But I was staying to myself, right? So I got my first DUI coming out of, I don't know, it was Peabody's or something like that down at the beach. And I blew a 2.7 that night. And so that's pretty high. Mm-hmm. And they took me to jail. And the one thing I remember about that night that was pretty wild, because we'd been drinking all day. We used to go play volleyball, and we played volleyball afternoon. Somebody said, hey, let's go down to the beach. Went down to the beach, and that's when we got busted. But I wasn't that drunk, I'll tell you that much. So 2.7 is pretty bad. For a normal drinker, they'd been under the table, passed out, maybe their heart stopped, I don't know. But for me, I had a high tolerance, right? You hear about that in the air. But I still remember the metal bars, because they took me to jail. Towed the car, took me to jail. And then one of my cousins, you know, got me out after a little bit. But I remember thinking in that jail cell that this is the worst thing that ever happened to me. This is what alcohol has got me. I'm sitting in a jail in Virginia Beach. Alcohol did this to me. I was ready for AA right then. I was ready. I didn't get there right away, because what happened was, you don't go to court right away, right? In a couple of weeks there, I had to do ASAP, which was the Virginia Alcohol Program. And they make you sign a sheet, you're not gonna drink while you're in this program of 8 weeks or whatever. I signed that, and I meant it. Man, I signed my name on it. And my cousins had a party, it was right down, their apartment was down the street from me on Holland Road, Virginia Beach. And I remember I went and bought a six pack for them. Bought it for them. Took it, and I got a good one. I mean, it was like a Heineken or Molson's or something like that. And I'm at this party, feeling kind of awkward. My cousins, they all worked at a place called Bennigan's, so there's all these hot waitresses and stuff like that there. And I'm feeling kind of awkward, and then, you know, before I knew it, I was, well, I'm just gonna drink one. And I drank one. And next thing you know, I drank two. And next thing you know, they're all gone. And it was me, because it was a six pack that I brought. And I remember thinking, what, and I was feeling good at that, but I remember thinking, shit, I did it. I didn't mean to drink that. And I was like beating myself up the best I could at the time, that wow, you got a DUI like a few weeks ago and you ended up in that jail cell and now you're drinking again. And that little six pack was all it took for me to go when they made me go to AA and get my slip signed. I was I had my ears open, put it that way. Now, when I went to Virginia Beach back then, there was a lot of Navy wives. It was a big mix of different types of people. But the meetings I accidentally went to in the beginning were open discussion meetings, right? Open discussions. And you get what you get in an open discussion meeting. They may never have even heard of this little book called Alcoholics Anonymous. Or they'll be quoting some stuff that may not ever be in this book, right? But anyways, I was torn a little bit because I heard some stuff and I was thinking, man, these people really just need therapy and good Medicaid. They're all crazy, you know? I don't get this whole thing. There was a part of me that was saying that, but there's a part of me that knew I was crazy. And I thought that's what my problem was that I was crazy, kind of like my mom. Didn't know I was just alcoholic. And my alcoholic solution to life was to drink. And that's all there was to it. So eventually in these meetings, I got lucky and ended up hearing some really, really good stuff. And the good stuff were coming from the guys that were talking about the big book. They also had this little black book called 24 Hours a Day. And my home group in Sunbury still uses this little book. It's a Hazelden book, which I'm definitely not against other things that aren't AA stamped literature approved, right? Because back in the day, they were, before the big book even, or even after the big book, they were using all kinds of stuff. What works? What spiritual stuff will get you closer to God? Because that is the essence of everything that we're talking about here. So when I finally got with some of those good guys in that meeting, I got my first sponsor, Randy Jamison, who's gone now, he's passed away. And this was me at 22. So from 22 to 25, I did the steps. I actually helped somewhere along that line, those 5 years, helped Randy chair a big book meeting. We used Joe and Charlie tapes, and some of y'all might have heard of Joe and Charlie over the years. But we actually had them on cassette. We had a stack of cassettes, and we'd listen to 20 minutes of Joe and Charlie, and then we open up our big books and we talk about it, and that was amazing. And it was really good stuff. We also did, at Randy's house, him and a bunch of other sponsees, we did a Emmett Fox Sermon on the Mount. We did that like a big book study. We read it and talked about it, stuff like that. That was the beginning of my AA stuff. And then at the 5-year mark, I had worked my way through the first 2 years of school, had found an awesome hot blonde, and she's coming with me. I was going up to JMU to finish my 2 years up at JMU, and we did that. And the one thing, too, I want to slip in about herpes thing is, that was the thing that I couldn't even write it down on the first 4 step because I was afraid. I was afraid that if I wrote this down on paper, somebody would find it in my apartment and publish it on the front page of the Virginia Pilot Ledger Star that I had that. And that is so weirdly self-centered and egotistical, it's unbelievable. But that was a fear. So luckily, I had a sponsor that when I told him that, and we did our first 5-step, he was like, really? That's it? That's the big bad thing that you were, that was it? I was like, yeah. And he's like, oh man, I thought it was really something really bad, but the wild thing is it was for me. And I've heard a lot of 5-steps in between here and there. And I know women that have had abortions that talk to me about that feeling of the shame and the feeling like you were, you know, zapped by God for some bad stuff. In a way of putting it, but I, from having done these steps, the first time with Randy too, I dealt with all that stuff in the 4th step of blaming God for what I thought happened to me. But boy, I tell you, when you get to that 4th column, and you realize what did I do to place myself in this position to be hurt? I did it. I was a slut. I really was, and it was my fault. And the fact that I don't even know who. I wanted to be mad at a woman, but I didn't know which one. But and then it came in, because AA has a way to put a spin on things, because I was kind of lucky that happened to me, and it pulled me out from doing that kind of lifestyle when other people in the mid-80s were rocking and rolling, and they were catching HIV and dying, you know? And so I in a way, that kind of saved me. So that was the first time in AA. I had sponsees, and when I moved away to Harrisonburg, I shook hands with my sponsor, and he's like, "Man, you know, we're just, you know, you're moving away, and you're kind of my sponsor more than I am your sponsor, and stuff like that." So when I got up there, I couldn't find anybody that fit my requirements of being a sponsor. And then I got doing this Native American men's group stuff. That it was Native American spiritual. We're doing sweat lodges and vision fast and all this stuff. It was, I thought, way up here spiritually. And I thought that AA was just kind of down here, little kindergarten stuff. You know, they're trying to find God. But these, you know, I'm hanging out with these people that they wouldn't drink alcohol or do drugs because it's just against this spirituality, you know, of being in contact with God. So I was so full of my own BS. But what it is, I drifted away from AA a little bit at a time. So when I moved back here to Chesapeake after finishing my 2 years at JMU, I came back to AA and it wasn't the same, right? And they were probably the same, but I wasn't. And that's, so I, when I went to the meetings, I found everything that was wrong with the meetings and didn't fit back in. So then I just stayed away from AA and got busy with work, you know? And I was teaching coming out of JMU because I went into JMU to save the world, man. I got changed in AA. It really did change me. I was going to be of service, be fit ourselves to be a maximum service to God and those about us, right? Going to do that. But I was teaching for a couple of years and working for a contractor on the summers, and they offered me double the money to come back work to them full time. So materialism is what got me. I got materialistic again. I got away from the program. I got self-centered in different ways. I wanted this, I wanted that. I wanted a Jeep Cherokee. I wanted a house. I didn't want to live in this little townhouse. I want a real house. I want to have kids. I want to be able to afford kids. And all this going on, I got, you know, further and further away from any kind of spiritual basis that had been my life, which had made my life so good. And eventually, I was up the chain in leadership and management, and everybody was going out for work for beers on a Friday night. And that's where it started. I went out, everybody's being cool, having beers. I can have a beer. And actually, before I actually took a beer out at Don Pablo's on a Friday night, I had experimented at home with O'Doul's. And I remember standing in front of that cooler going, you know, there's something weird about this. It just feels weird to be buying a beer after about 10 years sober, buying a beer. And it went from the O'Doul's, because O'Doul's, I drank it and was like, okay, it tastes like beer, but it's missing something. It's missing that kick, right? So I remember my first six pack, and I wanted to get, well, you know, I'm only going to do this as an experiment, and I'm going to drink a little bit. So I'm going to drink one good beer. I'm going to drink, so I got a Molson something, right? And I remember drinking that and going, oh yes, that's what was missing. And at first, and it's the control that was mentioned in More About Alcoholism. We wanted the ability to control and enjoy our drinking. See, and I couldn't do that anymore. I can't control my drinking, but I can't enjoy it when I'm trying to control it. If I let go of control, then I can stupidly enjoy it, right? Because I'll get wasted. So it all started there with me proving a point. I was going out for a couple of beers with the guys after work on a Friday night, and I was only having two. And I did it. And I know I've talked about people, and I know it's in me, the alcoholic in me, just to go do that, to go prove a point. But that's, I'd be proving a lie, right? Because the truth is, and this is what I learned from Joe and Charlie, is that I'm an alcoholic. I'm a real alcoholic, like they talk about in here. I'm an alcoholic. So for me to be able to say I'm an alcoholic, that's the truth. And for me to go drink, I've got to prove in my brain that I'm not really an alcoholic anymore. Oh, I've been sober long enough. Well, I did that before, and I was still just as much of a drunk when I started drinking again. Because I tell you, it didn't take too long from proving that I could only have a couple of beers when I was out somewhere to prove a point, to saying, you know what, this is game on, this is too much fun. But because of my job now, I still was sober maybe 3 days a week, you know? Because it started Thursday night, Thursdays, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, And then Monday was usually such a bad hangover day at work, you had to drink Monday night just to taper off a little bit. So then Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday at work, I did more work than other people did 5 days a week, and that's how I made up for it in my brain. Well, I know I'm only good for 3 days a week, but man, I'm good when I'm on, right? So it was always that guilt, and that's a feeling, and always that guilt of having to make up for being, you know, so hungover on most of the time. Now that was in the earlier days. At the end, it just didn't matter. I was hungover all the time. I had some rules, and one of them was, see, I work at St. J's in Portsmouth, and one of them was if I ever have to go to that 7-Eleven out there on the corner of Victory and GW and get a big beer at lunchtime, I'm gonna have to go back to treatment. So I wouldn't do that because I had to, I don't wanna not drink, you know? Because the insanity of alcoholism is I want to drink, and there's a part of my brain that does not want to drink, knows it shouldn't drink. Part of my brain, and it's worse later because I had been in AA. I knew what it was like to have a good life in AA. There's a part of my brain that says, you got to get back to AA. And the other drinking part of my brain would say, no, hell no, I don't want to ever not drink. And that's the insanity of it, right? So, and then the self-centeredness got so deep. So, you know, here I was at 19, drinking myself to death because I thought I would never have a woman and a normal life and everything like that. So I got myself a woman, got two kids, got a great job, had gone from contractor to government, and had a Harley, had a couple, but had a 2005 Heritage Classic when that night. And our marriage was kind of on the rocks anyways. As how could it not be? As we were reading the family afterwards the other night, that was so powerful. But the only time she was happy when I had a little bit of wine in her, and I always had to be real careful to get just the right amount of wine in her and the right amount of booze in me so that we could meet up, you know? Because if you give her too much, then she's crashed out and there's nothing happening. And if I got too happy, then I'd be useless. So it was really a balancing act there to keep Mama just the right amount. And I'll tell you, and another thing about running out of booze, and I'm not going to talk anymore about alcohol for whatever time I got left here, which I meant to turn that on. Okay, I've been talking too much about alcohol. This last one. One of the ways I knew I was an alcoholic was that I drank when I didn't want to because I felt like I had to. And there's plenty of times where I would drink the house out of everything. And I had a kitchen cabinet that was my little personal, you know, locker storage area, you know? And one time, I drank the house empty, and I even did it with her wine. She had that box wine, if you ever seen that stuff. It's in a silvery bag in a box, and you keep it in the fridge. And I don't like wine, but when it's the only thing around, yes, I would drink it. And then what I would do is I try to go get her I'd get her a nicer box of boxed wine, not like the generic shit, but the good stuff, and put it and try to make it look like I was giving her a present. Because I'm a sneaky alcoholic too, right? I'm trying to get credit for replacing the cheap wine I drank with some better stuff. And so one night I had drank everything out of the house completely, and there was nothing left except some gin, which was my mother-in-law's. And they came up, you know, a couple times a year. We kept some stuff for them. And that gin was pretty much untouched. And I hate gin. I can't stand the smell of it. I must have puked on one. That and Southern Comfort, I must have puked on when I was a kid. Just hated them, right? I remember thinking that's the only thing in the house, and the only thing to mix it with was Diet Dr. Pepper. And now what a weird-ass combination. But I remember gin and Diet Dr. Pepper, and I remember literally having to pinch my nose and get the first one in there and go, mmm. And then going for the second one and going, holy shit, you are a freaking alcoholic. And I can still remember that moment of going, wow, this is insane. But as deep as that feeling was of how bad my alcoholism was, I couldn't do anything about it on my own. Okay, so it took a motorcycle wreck. And it was October 14th, 2011. It was the Friday night, and it was a beautiful, like 75 degree night. And I got her to come out with me, had grandma taking care of the kids, and we went out on a bike and to a bar that I played at sometimes. Some friends of mine were playing there. And now, and it was getting close to midnight. And I had been drinking it all day since after work, right? It was a Friday. And anyways, we ended up, she came with me, got the kids in bed, came with me, and went and had some drinks. It was getting close to midnight. Even had somebody take a picture of us on the bike on the way out of there, which is pretty wild. And on the way home to Chesapeake, got to the top of a ramp, and there was some brake lights right there in front of me. And I remember downshifting, going, oh shit, shit, downshifting. And then what happened was I bumped the bumper and the bike threw the bike down. I got all banged up on the side. She was on the back, and sometimes I forgot to tell this part of it, but she, my wife was actually involved in this stuff. She actually got, like, her foot got caught on something, and she had a bone broken in her foot, or a little fracture. And I had a rib fracture, and I was black and blue. I had my cell phone was in my nice Harley jacket, which they cut off of me, which pissed me off, right? I had a rectangle that was deep, dark, black purple, and then from that, it was just, the purple grew day by day. It was just bruised more. And all the skin on my face and my hand and my legs. And they had me in the hospital. And while they were there, without my permission, they took my blood. And it was a 2.0, you know. So I was, you know, multiple times past the limit again. But this time, that was, it was Saturday the 15th. And that was... Last drinks were the 14th, Saturday the 15th. That was the hospital bills. That having to go get my bike out of the compound, the impound when I took the bike. And the bike was beat up a little bit. It wasn't that bad. A buddy of mine fixed it up. I ended up selling it. And that's a good story, too. Got the bike all fixed up, sold it, had $8,000 or $10,000 for this $20,000 bike, right? You know? And I took it to my wife and said, look, I sold it. Now I can do the master bathroom, and we can pay off this loan and stuff like that. And she basically said, okay. And I remember going to a men's group that night and going, my God, she is such a bitch. She doesn't realize what I just did. I just sold my bike to pay off our debt. And she didn't even like give me a thank you. And boy, I tell you, I do remember a couple of guys being really honest with me and saying, dude, you don't get no thanks for that. You're just doing what you should have done. That's it, you know? And I needed to hear that, right? I did need to hear that, because I wanted somebody to tell me, well, I should get a little gold sticker for my jacket or something, you know? But that was fixing the bike. She was on it. I poured out the booze. I told you about my little cabinet with the booze. So I actually poured booze down the sink as my promise to myself that I was doing this. Poured the booze out. And I was on like pain pills, of course, which I think helped me taper off that first week. Otherwise, I probably would have had to go to a detox and chill out in a detox and get right. But that was Saturday. By Sunday, my brain was all telling me, half of my brain, I should say, that, you know what, you're never going to be able to do this. You might as well just go get some beer. I'm like, where is that coming from? Oh, my God. And I really thought it was craziness. And that's why the big book, there's so much in here that tells me. It's like, yeah, it was crazy. It was the insanity. It was stuff too, right? Come to believe there's a power greater self that can restore us to sanity. Because I needed sanity in my life. So that was going on. Monday, I made phone calls to outpatient, local, inpatient, outpatient things. And I decided, well, I can't do 30 days of inpatient right now, but I will definitely, I'm going back to AA, and I will go get a counselor, and we'll deal with this thing. And then Tuesday, I went and met two of them, and I picked one of them, and she was a hottie. And I'm saying that on purpose here, because that's the way my brain still pays attention to things. Oh, she's hottie, she's spiritual, I can listen to her. The other guy was a hardcore AA guy, he flat out told me. I was like, good, I don't think I'm ready for that right now. I'll go to this little New Age honey over here, down at the beach. And Ashton, she was great. I stayed with her for a year, and she really helped me. She saw through my bullshit big time. And it was awesome. But that was Tuesday, and then that Tuesday night was a men's group. I was a closed men's group in Chesapeake. And I got in the minivan, sore, and I do remember sitting in one of these chairs, and they were about like this, they're blue. And to get up at the end of the meeting, to get up, when you get up, it's like this, you know, because when you've got a fracture on the rib, and you're pushing here to here, it takes a lot of ouch to get up, to get up. Go get that white chip. And to get that white chip of surrender
of recommitting myself to this A way of life, to saying, God, I need your help because I have effed my life up completely. Because the first time it was just me. Next time it's a wife, two kids, job, dogs, house, home,
and so I can still remember that. And I tell you, I was welcomed with loving arms by those guys. And one of the guys, and I, some of those guys are still around, you know, Tom and Joe, and my sponsor, Tim, who has since passed away too. Tim was there at that first meeting, and he later became my sponsor, because that night, everybody, they passed around the sheet, right? You know, got all these names. And they said, hey, go to this meeting. We're going to be over here. We're going to be here Thursday night. We're going to be here Friday night. We're going to be here Saturday night, because that's how it was in Chesapeake. And that's something I did for many people over the years myself, is I'd take that meeting list. I put stars by my home group. I put stars at the other meetings that I went to regularly, and I knew there was good people. There was good AA talk there. And so that first meeting was pretty powerful. And at my 30-day meeting, I was at Tim's home group, and he was giving out chips. And I had picked one up on Tuesday night, and this was Thursday night. So he was giving out the chips, and I went up to him, and I shook his hand, and I said, hey, I don't really need the chip, but I need a sponsor. And he's like, okay, talk to me after me. Yeah, talk to me. And so we talked, and he said, let's meet for coffee. Let's meet at Starbucks over here at Deep Creek. And I was cool, and so we talked, and he says, look, I know you were in AA before. He said, are you ready to do the 12 steps again? And I said, yes. Yes, sir. I'm ready. And he said, okay, so look, we're going to do it by the big book, and we're going to do it the same way that the people in the 50s and the 60s did it, because that's where my sponsors trace back from. And you're going to need a notebook, and you're going to need, and I know I've got some in here, you're going to need some index cards. Oh, here's one. The notebook is going to be, I'm going to show you what we did. Step one. Week one, was it called week one, week two, week three, and it might take you more than a week, but you know, this is what we're gonna do. And we're gonna do this together. We're gonna read the big book. And when you get done with these steps with me this time, the commitment is you don't owe me anything, but you're gonna commit to taking other men through this book this same way. This is the way we're gonna do it. And I said, yes, sir. Yeah, we'll do it. And even though I was kind of, because I had been in AA, right? And I knew a lot of stuff. Now, that was in from 87 to 92, and now 2011. There was a lot of years in between here and there. There was a lot of the last 10 or 11. That was all drinking years. But I had some sober years when I kind of drifted in out of a little bit. So I had learned a bunch of stuff. But the big book does tell us that you can have a bunch of head knowledge, and it just doesn't matter if you don't go into action and do it. And what I personally found, and I wrote some of this stuff down, I think I wrote it at the end of 164, no, I wrote it at the back of my big book. I was out at Wakefield for one of the Wakefield things, and I must have been a couple years sober at the time. And it finally gave me a couple of days by myself to think about my relapse. Because the big book talks a little bit about relapse. And one of the things it says in Two Wives, I think it's at the end of it, it says, when you've had a relapse, he knows what he has to do. He has to redouble up his spiritual efforts. You know, because that's the answer, right? If we go drink again, it's because we've had some stuff here that at some point we decide the only thing that's going to fix these things I'm feeling inside is to go drink. And we're back to insanity again in step two. And we missed step one. So these things that I wrote, here's my list of things I wrote in the back of my big book, because I don't want to forget these character defects, right? Denial of fears and of resentments. So I was denying that I ever had resentments, because I knew if I admitted I had a resentment, I have to work on it. I don't want to work on it. I just want to sit around and bitch about it a little bit. I have an inner critic that justifies and defends everything I do and think. That's a bad one. That inner critic as well, because my inner critic will tear them apart, make me look good. A victim. That's deep in my life, right? I grew up, so I was a victim. And it's so hard, and I deserve whatever it is I want. Awfulizing, poor me, awfulizing, making it way worse on me than everybody else in the world. And that's one thing about AA is that we come in, well, we've all got some bad sob stories, that they happen, right? But for me, because I'm so self-centered, my sob stories are worse than your sob stories. Mine hurt more. I was hurt way more than you. That's why I drank so much, you know? I drank so much because I'm an alcoholic. It's in my DNA, and I'm pretty cool with that. Even if you took away any of the bad stuff that happened to me, I still believe it's in my DNA. Get some booze in me, I'm going to want some more. It's going to feel good. Negative thinking and feeling is automatic. It's just so negative. Fantasizing, not accepting what really is, but running the movies of these fantasies in my head. Fear of the past and fear of the future, not trusting God now, in the now moment. I learned that in AA, be in the now moment. Blaming others, selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate of others' feelings and needs, even to my own kids. I heard a guy at the meeting last night talking about having loving and compassion for his dad who was drinking. And it was so wild. My sponsor, Tim, had to tell me so many times, dude, you need to practice compassion at home. Because he heard some of the stuff I was saying. But that was easy to come into AA and love people for AA, because you're alcoholics like me, man. We had all kinds of goofiness in my home group. And if you're in a good home group and it's big enough, there'll be some goofiness. There'll be people acting out some ego stuff, some unhealed areas of their life. And they'll probably act it out and it'll be weird and stuff. But I could accept that way more than I could my own family. It's pretty wild. I don't want to ever forget this. Spiritual pride. What, me effed up? No, y'all messed up. I'm okay. Control. Thinking I can be in control. Somehow I can control, like the big book says about the actor on in the stage in the play. The sick need for security. There's a part of me that wants everything to stay the same. Everybody be cool. The reason I am the guy in charge at work is because that's just me. I want to be in, but let's follow these processes and I'll get everybody to play the rules right so that everything is good. It's just part of me and a long list of fears. So that's what I wrote during this couple of days to sit around, hang out and talk AA with people. Those are the things that I don't want to forget. And what I had to do was go back to practicing what I learned at the pavilion where I went to treatment in 1989. And I went to treatment when I was like a year and a half sober because this place was run by some really spiritual people who were pushing the 12 steps big time. And they were saying that if you don't deal with the underlying issues, and this is still where it's at, where we're at in AA today, right? Some people mistakenly think that AA is just about not drinking. No, not just about not drinking. It's really important to not drink. It's a prerequisite, right? And it can be so simple. It can be so simple as remembering, if I don't pick up the first drink today, I won't get drunk. And it's always today. But don't pick up the first drink today. It's not the sixth beer that got me drunk. It wasn't that third shot of Jägermeister that really did it. It was the first drink. And after that, the whole point of all the steps is clearing away the problems, getting us closer to having some kind of relationship with God, right? And the little notes that I made the other night, since I got 5 minutes here, I actually started from the top working backwards. Step 12 is having had a spiritual awakening, we tried to carry this message to our other alcoholics. Right? What was the message? The message is you can have a spiritual awakening that can heal you of alcoholism. And I say heal, right? Not change it, right? The same as herpes. I'm not cured. There's the word I was looking for. I'm not cured of it. It's still a virus. It's still in me. It's still there. It still pops up every now and then, right? But I am healed of the shame, and I'm healed of the being a slave to it, the same as I've been healed of being a slave to booze. You know? It's Friday night here, y'all. It's Friday night and we're not drunk. Yeah. Isn't that amazing? Right? And sometimes I can forget about that in life. 3-day weekends always remind me. They always do. Because I would have had to prepare for that and get down to the ABC store to get enough booze to get me all through the weekend. Or there's a hurricane coming. Oh my God. I had to really go hurry up, get to the store, load up. Right? Because you don't want to ever run out. That's being a slave to booze. So anyways, I did want to share a couple spiritual awakenings real quick. One of them was in San Diego at a men's group. I was out there for work, been sober for a while, and it was a men's group, a small group of people. One of the members had come in, had been drinking for a month, was still shaken back at his first meeting. And another guy had been in and out a couple of times. So the whole meeting became about loving on these guys, saying, it's okay, man. No, you've been there, understand. We don't care what you've been through. We're so glad you're back. You know, and yeah, you're feeling terrible right now, but it's okay. What they did at their meeting, they had the St. Francis prayer on paper, and they threw it down on the floor, and everybody got shoulder, we didn't hold hands, got shoulder to shoulder, and we read that, Lord, make me an instrument of your peace. Where there's hatred, let me bring love. Where there's, you know, slavery, bring freedom. I forget all the stuff. But I tell you, by the end of that, I don't like to say I cry, but when the ice around my alcoholic heart start melting, it comes out my eyes sometimes. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's the way it is. So if my eyes are leaking, it's just the alcoholic ice melting, and it was powerful. I felt God in that room, but I also felt God one time. And I want to tell you all this one. I was probably about 90 days sober again. I felt like my whole life was completely effed up. It was just trash. I got a wife, I got a kids, got a job. Might lose my security clearance. My job would be trashed. And I couldn't sleep. And I was in a big chair in a music room, and I'm sitting in there, and I'm just crying because my life was terrible. And I remember I had this moment where, and I'm just going to tell you, I don't know if it was Jesus or if it was Holy Spirit. I don't know how to put any name on this feeling of love that was in that room with me. And I felt like I had screwed my life up so bad. It was completely, in Navy words, FUBAR, which is effed up beyond all repair. I thought that's what my life was. And this love, this washed over me. And I knew I was forgiven in a way that it was, I can't explain it any more than to tell you all those words, but it felt real. And I got up from that chair and I knew I'd had a moment with God, and I went into bed and fell asleep. And there's some stories in the back that are kind of similar to that. And that feeling didn't last forever, but man, it was a powerful waking up moment. And it's the spiritual awakening that I wanted to share that happens as a result of these 12 steps. And 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God. So prayer and meditation, and I want to encourage you, and the same with guys I sponsor, meditation doesn't have to be doing yoga stuff, sitting cross-legged, going to Om. It doesn't have to be like that. It can be as simple as taking a little bit of time in the quiet. You know, the prayer is talking to God, meditation is listening to God. That's a really simplified way of saying it. My prayer life is so different today because I actually pray for other people. I was so self-centered in the beginning. It was all about me. And I know the whole deal about the motorcycle crash in the beginning, that was all about me. My wife got left out of that story many, many times because it was about me and how I got hurt. I pray for other people now. Step 10. I told y'all about the character defects I know I've got to watch out for. Selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. Those are the main ones. But I also added pride and wanting to know the outcome and in control. The blessing of this program is I learned that, and I'm going to skip to making amends. We ain't got time to talk. Practicing the opposite is step 6 and 7. I admit what the problem is. I admit the negative thing at step 6. And what I do is I ask God for the strength and the gift to help me practice the opposite. So when I'm being afraid, God, will you please help me trust? You know, when I'm being self-centered in this particular area in my life, God, will you please help me think of other people? Go help somebody else. Pride. Man, Lord, please help me be humble. Just remind me I'm just a garden variety drunk who, by the grace of God, I'm here and sober on a Friday night. Many, many Friday nights all in a row, too. It's amazing. Step five, I already shared with you. I told you my worst one. I wasn't even right on there. step four, lists. Best thing I tell you people about step four is look for patterns. Look for patterns. That's what I do with the guys I sponsor. Let's look for patterns. And yeah, you can, the first time you do a step four, is get the book out. It's got to get out. Get it out. Next time, because there will be more, and that's the way I look at this 12 steps. It's not a one and done. It's not like a race from point A to point B. It's a kind of a circular and moving up. Moving up and getting out a little bit wider, a little bit deeper. We learn more about ourselves, you know, and hear about some of the stuff. Step one, two, and three, I wrote every day. And this is a men's group. I'm going to tell y'all exactly what I do with this. I don't usually do it. I roll out of bed, and I don't let my feet touch the ground. I roll out. I got a little rug beside my bed. Hit that bed. I do the first three steps. And the way I say them is, number one, I admit I'm powerless, still powerless over alcohol. My life's a man's world by me. God, I need your help. And that's the gist of it for me. I need God's help in my life. Life is still unmanageable if I try to manage it myself. Step two, come to believe that there's a power greater than myself that can restore me to emotional sobriety, spiritual sanity, not worldly sanity, spiritual sanity. And three, I say physical, emotional, and sexual health. So physical health, mental health, and sexual health, those three together. And then I say, thy will be done. Because our big book says that a bunch of times in there. So thy will be done. And I make sure I feel it. And I've also been praying to be connected with God in a daily walk. And I just say, Lord, please, as we go through this day, help me remember I'm with you. It's not me against the world. It's me and you just doing this life, right? And for me to be a service, because that's what it's big time about. So, and I talked longer than I thought. The 12 steps of AA are a healing, transformational system. And by healing, I know that's a pretty weird word, because I would have thought it was weird at first. But there's times in early recovery, or when I first walked in, I needed healed. I needed fixing, big time. I needed fixing. And I know there's still people in the room that still, we need some fixing in certain areas of our lives. And some people are at the point where they're remembering how they used to work their steps. And I'm just, the one reminder I want to bring tonight is that it's so important that we do. We keep working the steps. And we got to work it together. And we got to be in AA for that, right? That's part of the deal. So for the couple of new people that we heard there, out of everything I said, man, if you feel like this is too hard for you, or you feel like, man, I'll never be able to get time sober, look, don't even sweat that stuff. It's all okay. The most important thing is that there's hope. There's a lot of people here in this room that can believe for you what you can't believe for yourself, is that you can be sober and you can have your life changed in ways that you just wouldn't believe. Because I would think that I'd be living under a bridge, and I went through a divorce and sobriety, that I should be like renting a room from somebody for the rest of my life and driving an old beat up Volkswagen or something, I don't know, you know. But that's not the way any of this has turned out. Because God keeps taking care of me. And all I do is keep doing these steps and saying, God, I'll do my part of the deal that I wrote down. And I'll end on this. It was a contract with me and God where I said, God, I, Robert L. Serby Jr., will do whatever you want me to do as long as you take away this insanity of alcoholism that still has me wanting to drink when I'm trying to be sober here. And I said, I would do anything. And I'm the contracts guy. I know that's a wide open thing. Right? That's a pretty wide open thing. I asked one thing from God. I said anything in return for that. And so far, I tell you, that contract has been awesome. it's been very, very cool. So I want to end there, and thank you very much for letting me talk it with you today. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. That was great. Being willing, right? I can remember my early on, my sponsor said to me, "So how's that praying going?" I think my response, I don't think I know for sure, my response was, "It sounds an awful lot like me talking to me." Man, if I only knew just how dumb that sounded. But thank you very much. That was a great message. Our seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Money collected at this meeting covers rent, supplies. The rest is given to the Tidewater Intergroup, District 24, and the General Services